Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 26th, 2005. This session is Reverence for God, Islam and the Trinity, presented in the Fireside Room by Nellie Van Dorn Harder. Disc number VAN-2005-02. Let's listen in.
Again, I don't know who of you was here yesterday and who was not. Okay. So I thought maybe for those of us who just come in, maybe we'll talk 2 minutes about what we were discussing yesterday so that you can see where the natural sequence is of these talks, if there is a natural sequence to them, because maybe one question from you might just, you know, completely change the course of what we talk about, because it is very important that we also keep in mind what you want to discuss. Yesterday we talked about how do you do dialogue, why do you do dialogue, with whom do you do dialogue, should you do dialogue, and in a way I think we came to the main conclusions that the time of the traditional dialogue, you know, very polished, mostly men, sorry to say so, sitting together, talking to each other like what's in the Bible, what's in the Quran, and coming to really something, but not very much. That we now have come into a time that we have become more active, especially considering what's happening in the world today, right? And then we ended in a way with some very good proposals. We said, how can we do this? And one of us said, I forgot your name, but you said it.
Dave
said, learn together. That is the way to do it, learn together. And then the very end, I shared with the group that at the Lutheran Seminary in Chicago and also in St. Paul, now there is a program for Muslim studies, Christian Muslim studies. And in St. Paul, they have a lot of students who are from Muslim countries who will be pastors there, doing MAs and PhDs. And in LSTC in Chicago, they have even gone a step further. They have Muslim students, people who are leaders of Muslim communities in Turkey, for example, imams, you know the word imam when I say that, and they are studying Christian theology. And so that was the hope with which we ended yesterday. Someone said, we need to have hope. That is our last conclusion. And then I explained to you that today we're going to talk about what do they think about us, how do they look at us. And you saw that title with that heavy word, the Trinity, right? And it comes down to, you know, what do they think about the Trinity, if they think something about the Trinity at all, the Muslims, that is. And so we're going to go on about that today. And before we start, I want to show you this. I forgot to show you this yesterday. Maybe some of you saw it in the bookstores. This is by a book by Diana Eck, which is very useful if you want to have an idea of what's happening in this country. It is, she has traveled all over the states to see how is our religious landscape changing. And she herself was shocked. She said, we have now more Muslims than Presbyterians, more Muslims than Lutherans, for example. And our landscape, our religious landscape is changing. So I forgot to show this yesterday. Shall I pass it around for those of you who are interested in seeing it? You might want to, if for your classes or for your church groups or anything like that, you might want to use it. Okay, now I think I have to give the sign to the video person who is hiding somewhere that they can start now. I'm not sure where they are, but they can start. So now we are going to talk about who do they say, and they are the Muslims. Who do Muslims say we Christians are? And I wanted to start with some kind of a story, and see if you can come up with, if I ask you a question, with the answer to the question connected to the story. Once I met a very, very famous man in Egypt, and to do that I had to dress in a Muslim veil, and that was, you know, I had to go through a lot of secretaries before I could make the appointment. And I went to his, well, I can almost say castle. It was outside the, beyond the pyramids, where there is a lot of green in the desert. And there he had a huge villa, lots of Mercedeses in the driveway. And I kept wondering whose those were. And three telephones, a white, a red, and a black one. And those kept ringing. And we had a talk with him. And I was with a friend, by the way. We had our interview with him. And we came back. And we went straight to the Marriott and each ordered the whiskey, which we normally never, ever drink. We just were so... And then we were sitting there, sipping something we don't like. And trying to figure out what had happened to us. And one of us then said, this was the most unspiritual, uninspiring person I've ever met in my life. This person was so worldly, he's stuck in the mud with his feet. It's like the Nebuchadnezzar story. Who do you think we met?
Yes, sir. So that.
Sadat? No, he was dead already.
No.
See, you immediately think he was an official from the government, right? We met the most popular TV preacher of the Muslims. And we met the man who every week in prime time, which in the Middle East is on Friday, right after the Friday prayers, would give sermons on TV. In the 80s, his eye fell on Christianity. Why? Well, because as you might know, Egypt is very much sponsored by American money, right? We spend a lot of aid in Egypt. And at the same time, there were all kinds of initiatives going on for Christians and Muslims to talk together. So his eye had fallen on the Christians. And in prime time, you could hear the most awful things about us. And about us was they believe in that Jesus was God. But he married Mary Magdalene and he did everything and then he went on like what babies do and so forth. You know what we all do, to discuss in great detail what human beings do. How can this be God? How can God marry? How can God have sons? How can God, is there some kind of a great-great-great-grandson of God walking around, and so forth, and so forth. And then a few weeks later, you would find his sermons in the street. And that way, he literally poisoned the mindset of a whole generation. The generation that is now in their 20s, 30s, 40s. This one man did that. And the most highest, not highest religious authority, the most respected and the most visible authority. Now guess who paid him? Wild guess.
We did.
No? Thank God we didn't. We didn't ask
him. Say oil money.
Saudi Arabia. Oil money. Saudi Arabia paid him. He was a know-nothing, because then I wanted to know more about him. He was an absolutely know-nothing. And then suddenly he was shipped off to Saudi Arabia, given a special education, and given prime time on TV. He came out of nowhere and had the TV. And he kept the TV for about 15 years. And his programs went into Sudan, Somalia. I've once read a story of a girl who grew up in Sudan, how sick she was of hearing that guy every day during the Muslim fast. And so, what does this tell us? What does this tell us, this story, that this could happen in a country of 60 million people, where there are 8 million Christians, the Coptic Orthodox Christians? What does this tell us about Muslims, about what can happen in a Muslim country?
It takes just one person.
But what else? If this would happen here, what would happen?
We call him Jerry Falwell.
We call him Jerry Falwell, okay. What else would happen?
Well, it also shows that the people listening don't really have any idea of, right, of what Christians are all about, and so that's the first thing they've heard about.
Right. They have 8 million Christians in their country. But, you know, his authority seems to be higher about Christians than the authority of the Christians. Why not go and ask them, right? But it says something else. What about this Christian community, well, these 8 million?
Does it also say that, I'm just speculating, that the Muslims themselves aren't well-versed in their own religion?
The Muslims themselves are perfect. The Muslims themselves do not quite know what is in the Quran, and if they do know, they follow interpretations of this guy, for example, because what he did, he interpreted the Quran for them as Jerry Falwell interprets the Bible in a certain way. And that they follow, because everybody follows it, and nobody protests. That is the key issue. Nobody protested. The Copts, the Christians, and I were very hurt. That's why I wanted to see the guy before he dropped dead. And it's the only person I've ever met in my life. When I heard he was dead, I thought, thank God. No, really, it was. He died in 98. But you think, why is it not possible that someone stands up and says, what you're saying there is nonsense. First of all, we do not believe in three gods as the gods and goddesses of, let's say, indigenous religions. Secondly, Jesus was not married to Mary Magdalene, right? Jesus did not have children, and so forth and so forth. But nobody dared to do that. Nobody dared to do that. So what we're talking about is great misinformation. Misinformation on both sides. And so if we say, you know, if we talk about interfaith dialogue, as we did yesterday, remember I kept saying it's not what's in the Quran, but what Muslims say and believe what's in the Quran. That's what it is about. And that's what we are facing. So I have now a program for 2 days here. And so the coming days, I want to discuss these issues, like how did this come about and why is it so important to understand this mindset? Understand, you know, if you say, because yesterday we also talked about who do you talk to? If you talk to, you know, American-raised Muslims, American-educated Muslims, they will have very different perspectives on Islam than, for example, someone in Egypt who's never been out of Egypt. Now guess who the leaders are of the people who have extremist thoughts? Are they born and raised in the States? The leaders?
No.
They're not. They are like, remember the old blind person who was behind the first World Trade Center bombing? Remember him? This old man, he's now in jail since a long time. Omar Abdurrahman was his name. Yeah. He comes from the dustiest village imaginable in the southern part of Egypt. And from there, he sent his ideas into the world. And then some followers put it on the net, and that is how it comes to America. So, as I said yesterday too, the sources are not here. The sources are, for example, in Saudi Arabia. The sources are, for example, in Egypt. So what you have is some very strange things, and that is something we always have to keep in mind. We are living in the States, we have lots of Muslim friends who are very much at the same level of thinking as we are, but we have also Muslim friends who get their ideas from a dusty village in Egypt or in Saudi Arabia. And those friends, they don't really want to talk with us. And those friends, they can have a certain role in, shaping perceptions about us. And it is those friends that we have to try to catch one day. In the sense that not lock them up, talk to them. Talk to them, find them. Because what happened, and I must, the hope part of the story, is the person who said we have to have hope here yesterday?
What?
No? The hope part of the story, what happened is this. I'll write down his name. His name was Sha'arawi, the man with whose story I started. Sha'arawi, Sheikh Sha'arawi. Sha'arawi. He got ill at the end of his life, of course. He was almost 80 and he got ill. And he was flown to Egypt, to London, from Egypt to London. And there the doctors treating him happened to be two Coptic surgeons. Coptic Orthodox surgeons who had fled Egypt because their family had been suppressed and they had been denied the place at the Faculty of Medicine. So they had gone out of Egypt to study in England and had become quite famous surgeons. And it seems that he talked with them at great length while being severely ill, was flown back to Egypt, and just before he died, told his helpers to recant what he had said about Christians. But they didn't do it in public. So it is something, he called the Pope, and I heard it from the Pope, you know, the Copts of Egypt had a Pope, you know that, the Patriarch. He told me the story. He called the Patriarch in a few days before he died and asked for forgiveness. Said, I am sorry I've done this. So in a way, yesterday we talked about space, finding space to talk, finding space to share. But in order to do that, why was it good that he had two Coptic surgeons and not one of us? Because they understood his mindset. They understood what he was thinking about them. They understood how to talk with him. And they obviously grasped the opportunity and did that. So that is how we are going to discuss what is happening, you know, within Islam about Christianity. First of all, about the Trinity. What do you think Muslims think about the Trinity?
What I've heard is one story was that the Father married and the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit as the Father, Mother, and the Son.
Right. True. Absolutely. It's in the Quran. The Trinity, according to Islam, was the Father, the Son, and Saint Mary. Where did they get it from? Those of you theologians among us, what do you think they got that from?
Dan Brown.
Close, you're close. No, they got it from sects, heretical sects, Christian sects in the Middle East. You know, because remember, this was the 7th century when Islam came into existence, 6th, 7th century. Remember that only in the 4th century, at the Council of Nicaea, the dogma of the Trinity was laid out. Remember that early Christians really had trouble thinking about what is this Father, Son, and Holy Spirit? And who of us has no trouble with it? If you really want to wrap your mind around it, you have to be a good pastor or something, right? Like you guys are. But otherwise, it's really hard. It's a hard concept. And it took the early Christians a long time too to settle it down. And then by the 5th century, they were fighting and battling over who was Jesus, right? Remember that, those battles? Who remembers those battles? None of us? Who knows about those battles? You know, was Jesus God, half human, totally human? What was he? That's why we have all these sects, remember? That's why we have Nestorians, Monophysites, and so forth, and so forth. You look so confused. Have you ever heard of these people? Just think sects. We had lots of sects, and we had to come down to some orthodoxy and decide who was Jesus and what was the Trinity, right? Well, that message didn't come in the newspaper in the 6th century. So people on the ground kept battling about what they believed, and it was so complicated for them that they came down, we understand, Father, Son, and Mother, that's what it is. And so that is what then, for those of us who don't believe that the Quran was directly written by God, came in the Quran. And that is what Muslims eventually think the Trinity is. So, if you would ask a Muslim about the Trinity, an average Muslim in an average town, would they care? No, they wouldn't care. Would they know exactly what's in the Quran? No, because they don't read the Quran for that. What do they read? They read the interpretations of the very earliest interpreters of the Quran. That's what they use. Who were these people? Who were these people? We know where Islam was born, right? In Saudi Arabia. The Prophet Muhammad was born in Mecca. During his life, he had to flee to Medina because the people in Mecca were trying to kill him. And in Medina, he finally could set up a community that had its own social rules, its own economic rules, its own political rules, That all happened in Medina. Do you want me to write those names down, or are we all okay with them? Who wants me to write it down? Be honest, I can do it. Okay, Mecca and Medina. Mecca, he was born, and that's where Muslims from all over the world go to the pilgrimage once in their life. Have you heard about the pilgrimage? Mm-hmm. That was the Mecca. And then he had to go, he had to flee to Medina. And what is very important, that we have to remember that there were three Jewish tribes there, and we'll come back to those tribes. So you see, he didn't make very many trips abroad, right? Before he was called to be a prophet, he was a merchant. And in those days, he did go to Syria, what is now Syria, Israel, Jordan, that, there he went. And that's where people think he got those ideas about the Trinity, because that was an area with lots of Christians. By the way, do we know that in the time the Prophet Muhammad was born, the Middle East was almost 100% Christian? Do we all realize that?
No.
Well, this is important to remember. Never forget. By the 5th, 6th century, the Middle East was 100% Christian, more or less. There were a lot of sects, but there were a lot of Christians there. And the Middle East was ruled by the Byzantines. By the what first was the Roman Empire and then Byzantium. That's important, and that's why they, you know, the emperor said, you're now Christian, so they were Christian, right? So that is very important to realize. So there comes this Prophet Muhammad. And now I have to take you back to history, I'm sorry. Were you ready for that at 4 o'clock in Holden Village? I have to do that because otherwise you will not understand it. So there is born this Prophet Muhammad, or this person called Muhammad. When he's around 40 years old, he gets his first revelation. And as the revelation goes on, while he still lives in Mecca, he thinks he's a renewer. He's a renewer of Christianity and Judaism. Because he has heard from his trips as a merchant that Christians are all fighting among each other about who's Jesus, what's the Trinity. They're fighting. They have sects. So he thinks that he is going to bring the final message. Christians will say, thank you, thank you, thank you. We're so happy you bring us that. And that he, like a prophet from the Old Testament, will set them straight. That's what he thinks while he's still in Mecca. And how does he think that? Because the first time he has this revelation, does anybody know what happened when he had this first revelation? He was scared to death. He was trembling and sweating, which you are anyway in Saudi Arabia, I guess. But he was so scared. He had no idea what happened to him. What happened was, according to the tradition, that something came from the far horizon and told him, read or recite. Depending on how you translate it. He said, I can't read. And I said, recite after me. And then the very first verse of the Quran was revealed, which basically says, I am God, recite, I'm God, I'm only one, and I made you. That is what it says. It is in, if you have a Quran, it is in the 96th chapter, the first five verses of the 96th chapter. So that's what happened. He was so scared. He didn't know what to do with himself. So he ran home. And there he had this wife who was a person with a good head on her shoulders who said, I'll call my uncle, Waraka, because he just became a Christian. Maybe he knows something about this. And this Waraka said, this happened to the prophets in the Old Testament. You will have to listen. When this comes back again, you listen. Because you are called to be a prophet. And thank God, I'm going to die soon. Waraka, the uncle of his wife said, or he was a cousin or something. Thank God, I'm going to die soon because you will be persecuted for your message, because every prophet is being persecuted for his message. So you see why he thought that he had a Christian Jewish message. He was put right away by this one person who recognized this experience in the tradition of the prophets. Okay? Can we follow me? Mm-hmm. This is very important to understand. But then he had to flee Mecca, and I cannot go into there, but it comes down to economics. He attacked with his new message their system of polytheism and their big, what do you call it, pilgrimage to the shrines of the different gods and goddesses. And you know, have you ever, has any of you ever made a pilgrimage? Pilgrimage is very profitable. Very, right? People have to eat, people have to sleep, people buy gifts. And they did that already in the 6th, 7th century. So the people in Mecca were really mad when he came with this new message that said, oh, these gods and goddesses are worthless, there's only one god. Yeah? And then then he had to flee to Medina. And only there, Islam became the religion it is now. If you look at the Quran, you have two types of verses. The first type is very universal. It says there's one God only, there will be a day of judgment, and you have to take care of your poor. Now, is that a universal message or not? Very universal. Everybody can recognize that message. And then you come in Medina and you get all the verses that we now know of, the four wives and the wife beating. Haven't you heard of those verses? Mm-hmm. Right? And the jihad, right? All that is from the time in Medina, where Islam then becomes a religion in its own. But you see, in the beginning, there was a lot he could identify with Christianity, with Judaism. Also, at the end of the stay in Mecca, as the pressure grew and they, you know, they persecuted him and wanted to kill him, had killed some of his followers, he started to identify with the prophets from the Old Testament. And then you find in the Quran stories about Abraham, stories about Moses, David. He started to identify with all those, especially those who had to struggle before they succeeded, okay? Now, can you put in your head the word success? Yeah? And remind me if I forget to come back to it. Success, succeeded. Okay, so that is what happened. That's what we really have to realize. Who of you knew all this? Some of you must have known it, yeah? Okay, yeah, I'm sorry that for the benefit of everybody else, we have to repeat it. And so, when he came to Medina, he thought, ah, fantastic, there are three Jewish tribes here. They will understand my message. Well, what did they do? We know Orthodox Jews, don't we? We know that Orthodox Jews only read the Torah in Hebrew. You're not supposed to change one little dot. We know that, don't we? Okay, so there comes this guy and says, I had this revelation on Abraham and Moses. And he tells what was revealed. Yeah, it were almost the same stories, but they're slightly off. They're not completely the same. There is a little difference. So the Jews say, wait a minute, that's not in the Torah. Yeah, this is nonsense. This guy is a fake. Well, you can't have that when you want to start a new religion, right? Competition. So that's the first C, competition. Remember yesterday we had all these C's of colonialism and things like that? This is the first C in the history of Islam, competition. And it is really competition. It is the biggest C that we have to keep in mind when we understand how Islam developed and why Muslims look at Christians in most of the Muslim world, most parts of the Muslim world, the way they do. Because to get over the competition, the Jews had to disappear. And when you then look in the Quran, you see several ways of speaking about Christians and about Jews. About Christians, the Quran has a divided mind. And I will talk a little bit more about that later. It has a divided mind of, these poor people who believe there are three gods. They're a little bit led astray. But in the end, they're not bad. But don't be friends with them. That's what it says in the Quran. Stay away from them. And on the other hand, they have monks and nuns. Silly not to marry, but they're good-hearted. So you see, there is this double attitude. The Jews, however, whoa. There's no hope for the Jews in the Quran. No, they're arrogant, they want to kill the Muslims. And the biggest accusation is that they changed the scriptures. And that is the next thing, change. Anybody wants to know the Arabic word? No? Okay, yes. You do? Okay, takfir. with a ha and a long I, tahrim. It means, what it means is this, that then, and you see this all in the Quran, and I'm not going to sit here and read the Quran for you, because then we would, oh, well, we could take a nice nap, of course. But, you know, in the Quran, you see this development where first there is this idea that the Jews actually are against the Muslims. And then in the real historic developments, the Jewish tribes are thrown out of Medina. That goes gradually, the first Jew tribe is expelled and they can take everything they have. The second tribe is expelled and they have to leave all their possessions behind. And the third tribe is basically murdered. So after 2-3 years, there's not one Jew left in Medina. So you see, then you really have, again, the situation where you can develop your religion and your message as you like it without any resistance or other voices. Because in Medina, there were no Christians, yeah?
2 or 3 years?
2 or 3 years, yeah.
Very short time span.
Very well, the time in Medina was only 10. Till 632, when the Prophet dies, 622 is the big trip. So it was only 10 years. Yeah, only 2-3 years. It went very fast. Once they came in Medina, things went very fast. And that is basically what Muslims refer to. You know, if Muslims have to think, how do we look at Christians? How do we look at Jews? They refer to one small place, which, gosh, maybe 5,000 souls in Medina, right? One small place in the Arabian desert, with three small Jewish tribes that were slowly eradicated, and the answers of the prophets and his reaction, the Prophet Muhammad, to those tribes and to questions about people of other faiths. That is what they have to base their whole discourse with Christians on. Do I make sense? Yeah? And that became then interpreted. Yeah, one second, yeah? The verses in the Quran then became interpreted by locals. Because that's what we always forget. We think now Islam, you know, 1.2 billion people all over the world. The first interpretations were done by people living around Medina. They interpreted the way they were used to do in the Arabic tribes. And so you see, basically the problem is that a Muslim who has to believe that the Quran is the direct word of God, who has to base what he or she believes on the Quran and the explanations of the Quran that were made in the early centuries, there is not very much there. There was, of course, a whole environment of Christians and Jews, but that is not in the Quran. You see what I mean? Because of the competition. The Islam felt, we have the right message. The Prophet said, I came to correct what the Jews and then later on the Christians changed. What I say is the true word of God, and you who don't believe it are wrong. So that is what we look at, what we are looking at.
Just the historical question, I remember reading somewhere that there was some also economic involvement with the Jewish tribes, and there was an alliance, and one of the Jewish tribes betrayed Muhammad, and that's what led to the rejection. Yeah. So there was economic trading off and warfare involved.
It all comes down to money and politics, doesn't it? Yeah, I don't want to go into that,
sorry,
because it's a long story, but things happened. These tribes were not expelled just like that, but it was, you know, finding ways to get rid of them, if you look back. Yeah. So that is our problem. We yesterday we talked about how we are in an era of globalization. We are coming closer and closer together. We don't have this issue that we can read the Bible literally, right? We can read some interpreters literally, but still we have much more freedom in how we look at the Bible. Also, we have the freedom to accept that there might be things in the Bible that are contradictory, aren't there?
We have the freedom to say, well, our times have changed. We now have to somehow adapt our message and look at what, you know, the bumper sticker. What would Jesus do, right? That is the big difference. Now, if a Muslim says, what would Muhammad do? Then he has two pictures. He has the picture of what happened to the Jews and what is in the Quran about the Jews. And he has the picture of what happened with the Christians. Now, as I said, there were no Christians in Medina. However, there is a story that once, and that is in the Quran too, a group, a delegation came up from the south of Arabia, what is now Yemen. Everybody knows Yemen? That used to be a Christian country. And a delegation of Christians came up to Medina. They had heard about this prophet who had become more and more popular and successful, and they wanted to see for themselves who this person was. So, a bishop came with his deacons to talk to Muhammad. What the Muslims wrote down, first of all, was the splendor of their garments. The bishop had this beautiful robe, you know, inspired by Rome, remember? With a beautiful hat, and they sat down, and then the bishop made the mistake of history, you could say, historic mistake. He started to talk about the Trinity. He tried to explain the Trinity to the Prophet Muhammad, who became so confused that he took refuge in what you call an old Arab way of solving problems, which is, let's curse each other. You say, let's curse each other.
Of course.
And if you curse each other, then you end up somewhere, you know, in the sand in the middle, and that's where the problem then stays, you know. So it is in the Quran, let's curse each other. And the bishop left, and the Prophet Muhammad, I keep on calling him a professor, Prophet Muhammad was very confused, and that was the end of it. And that was the end of an opportunity to talk about Christian theology. It was dead. And then, I see your hand. Did you want to ask something first, or?
No. Several of us didn't understand the word scourge.
Curse. C-U-R-S-E. Curse. We don't do that anymore. We don't curse each other anymore. But that's an old Arab method. If you cannot solve a problem, you throw curses to each other. I can't help it. And then, you know, you kind of neutralize the problem, or if one of you is really wrong, evil will attack you. Does it make sense? Who can follow it? I've often thought how they did that. I'm not sure. Yeah, so that is something we have to always keep in mind. The beginning, the start was bad. In many ways, the start was bad. And then, when the Prophet Muhammad died in 632, he died unexpectedly. He just died of flu-like symptoms, and he died unexpectedly. And he had guided the community like Moses did, you know, in everything. He was the judge, he was the social worker, he was everything. So family disputes between man and wife, he took care of it. So he was dead overnight. And they were shocked. They were in shock. Because they had this feeling like a prophet doesn't die. What do we do next? And so what they then decided is that they would follow his plans for the future. His plan had been to go out of Arabia to where you have now Syria, Jordan, and so forth, and meet with tribes there. And so that's what they did. Now, I have to go back to one more point. The Prophet Muhammad, during his life, thought that this message that was going to correct Christianity and correct Judaism, he thought that it was only for the Arabs. Because, and this is also very important, it was only for the Arabs. Why? Because they were the only ones who were still polytheists in the time. At the time, the rest, as I said, of the Middle East was mostly Christian and Jewish, not polytheist any longer. And so they didn't know what to do. And so they followed him and said, okay, we'll go out and see what happens. And then we see the biggest change in history. They went out on their horses. They went from city to city.
And they said, we are Muslims, we are here to protect you. All you need to do is pay us tax and we leave you alone. And the people who were, you know, all had this Byzantine occupation, they didn't mind this Byzantine occupation. That was a good option to them. And you can read that in books there were bishops reflecting on how much better the Muslims were than the, do you say Byzantines or Byzantines?
Both.
Okay. Thank you. So then somehow what happened also surprised the Muslims. All of a sudden they went out and out and out. They went on their horses from Medina and they stopped in Spain. They went all through the Middle East, North Africa, and they stopped in Spain. Where in the year, if I'm not mistaken, 710, they were stopped at the south of France. So think about it. This was like less than a century that they went all over the Middle East, North Africa, and even into Europe. Everywhere saying, we are Muslims, we come in peace, you don't have to convert. We just simply pay us and we will protect you against the oppressors. And then you read the stories how in Egypt, you know, the ships went to Rome of the Byzantines and never came back. They just left everything behind and let the Muslims be where they were. It was very strange. It must have been a time in history where an environment was ready. That is what happened. So now we come in a time where suddenly you have this handful of Muslims in this ocean of Christians and Jews. What do you think happened? What do you think naturally happened?
The Christians and Jews got bent out of shape.
The
Christians and Jews got miffed.
Christians and Jews got miffed? Anything else? Anybody else who has an idea what happened?
They fought over Jerusalem.
Huh?
They fought over Jerusalem.
They fought over Jerusalem.
The Crusades started.
Crusades. Yeah, but that's much later, right? The Crusades is a couple of hundred years later. But in the very beginning, what do you think happened?
Did things change and they developed armies and pilfering and pillage?
Yeah, not quite. The very first thing that happened was that most Christians saw this was a sect again. This was one more sect. They did not realize this was a religion. This was a different religion. They did not realize this, and there is the most powerful issue in Islam. How was it spread? Not through pilfering. Intermarriage.
Oh.
Intermarriage. And again, the other C is capitalism. Why? Because what happened was, do you all want to know all this? Mm-hmm. Yeah? What happens is, okay, you have a big city, huh? New York, okay? There come, on their horse, 20 Arabs. They say, okay, we just put our tents here and we will protect you against the Byzantines, New Yorkers, okay? You pay us, so think about it. New York was still small in those days, maybe. 100,000 New Yorkers paying 20 Arabs. You do the math. All of us who are in economics, you see what's happening. Within a few years, everybody wants to join these people who won the jackpot. It was already a jackpot, right? Now, how could you join? By becoming a Muslim. Plus, these 20 on their horse had a wife at home but came alone. In the Quran, you can marry four. So, they married, right? So slowly you get an interaction. But the interaction was not religious. The interaction was to get jobs, to get married, and then there is the rule that once you only a Christian or a Jewish woman can marry a Muslim, and once you're married, your children are automatically Muslim, and you can never convert back. That is the safety valve. And that is how Islam spread, demographic. But you see, it took the Christians quite a while to wake up. It took them quite a while to get to formulate an answer. Plus, they were so busy fighting. And then when they started to formulate an answer, it was too late. By then, lots of Christians had become Muslims, And who had become Muslims among others? Christian philosophers, Christian legal minds. And they helped the Muslims then set up their system that we now have today. And so when then the Christians started to fight back, so to speak, started to have debates and things, the Muslims debated back with the voice of Christians who were converted. Right? And we said, well, you're all quarreling all the time. Islam doesn't do that. Islam is clear. There's one God, five pillars, and we know what we're at, and we like it this way. And not all this, you know, fuzziness about Trinity, fuzziness about Jesus is God, is not God. No, Islam is clear. This is it. And we believe that indeed the Prophet Muhammad came to correct. And so that is how we come at the situation where we are now. You see, in a way, Christianity was the competition, the big competition, and that had to be overcome. So on the one hand, you have that Islam completely closes itself off for everything that is not Muslim, right? And on the other hand, Christians didn't realize. They didn't realize what they were doing. They just became Muslim without a thought. But it took to the Middle Ages, till about 1500, that the Middle East went from half-half to the majority Muslim. It took that long. And all the time, the Muslims were the rulers. And that is, but you see, so if you rule, you don't have to have dialogue. If you rule, you can create the scriptures that you want to create. And if you rule, then you can give people a certain position. Does it make sense to us?
Sounds familiar.
Well, I don't want to go there. But that is the whole, that is, you know, if we talk about why dialogue, how dialogue, with whom dialogue, then we have to realize that most of the Muslim world, most Muslims in this world, that's their reference. That's their reference, you know. This is what they'll set. This is what's said by the Quran, but mostly this is what's said by the interpreters. The first interpreters were from the Arabian Desert. The second group of interpreters were apologetics against Christianity. And that is what became the, let's say, the main body of reference for most Muslims. So to break through that, can we see what a huge job there is to do? What an enormous job there is to do. Because at the same time, most Muslims in this world have never seen a Christian in their life. We talked about that yesterday. It's very unfamiliar. Who are those Christians? What do they believe? And so these stories that developed before the Middle Ages, they have not really changed in many places. And then we have the other C word. Some of you said it already. Yes? The Crusades. Because if we now want a little bit of, I hate to do this to you, but think 1250. It was actually 1258, but 1250 is easy to remember. If we now want to kind of think about how this then developed, until 1250, you had this immense Muslim empire. Have you heard about it? This immense Muslim empire that included Spain, where there were no borders, kind of like a United States of Islam, right? No borders, lots of universities, people could travel from Morocco to India without having to stop anywhere and being checked for passports and so forth. And Islam, in the mind of Muslims, Islam then ruled. We know it's not true. We know that the Islam Muslims were still a minority, but they were the rulers, okay? So around 1250, that collapses. That empire, that was one big empire where people could travel and where they could learn and where they could talk together, collapses. And that is at the same time the time of the Crusades. So do you see why the Crusades are so bitter? I have such a bitter taste in the Muslim mind. Because the idea then is, my God, what happened? We had this huge empire, we ruled everything, there came the Crusades and they stirred us up and disturbed us, and then the next step is the next C word that we talked about yesterday, colonialism. So you see, what we're talking about is a, it's like a time frame of, let's say, almost 1,000 years that nothing really changed, right? That the Muslims felt more and more suppressed by the West, felt more and more pushed away by the West, and you know, Christians were not interested in dialogue apart from, you know, Muslims should convert, right? And so there is this feeling that Christianity is not just a religion, but a whole culture, a whole package, right? Capitalism, we talked about yesterday, Dynasty and Dallas on TV, right? All the whole package is much larger than just religion. And that is why, you know, if you say, why do they hate us so much? Well, that is why. It's a package that built up over almost 1,000 years. And in the mindset, it's a, how could we lose? How could we lose? And in a way, religion doesn't really matter in this package. So you see, if we say, we talk about interfaith issues, want to talk about the Trinity, that's fine, but you won't have any gain because it is not talking about what really matters. You see? Now I have been storming at you with so many facts. Are there any questions or remarks or things you would like to know before we go on? I'm only at the first point of 8, by the way. Yeah.
Is it still true today that Muslim men can marry 4 women?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Oh, it is.
Oh yeah. And this is a very interesting little something. In the Muslim world itself, it's getting very hard to do that because governments, you know, women are more educated. And governments realize that the old rules cannot be applied, but it is in the Quran. And that brings me to the Quran. And I have to keep an eye on our time. Everything that's in the Quran is the word of God. And that's why I suggested this book. I'm not sure if it's still in the bookstore, if you want to have a look, by Father Ishaq. Everything that's in the Quran is the word of God and is holy. You cannot change it. Since it is in the Quran that you can marry 4 women, you cannot change that. So people have to take that into account. Muslim governments would fall. There would be revolution if they would say we scrap that. So what it is now that you can marry up to 4 wives, but the first wife has to give permission in court. You think that will go easy? Right. And then the man has to prove that he can take care of both the first and the second, third, fourth wife equally. Like 4 houses, that's why, you know, you only see very rich or very poor people having more than 1 wife. And then the second wife, if she doesn't like it, can ask for a divorce. If the first wife allows and the second wife says, well, it doesn't work out, she can ask for a divorce. Because, you know, getting a divorce, according to Islamic law, is very difficult for a woman. So that is what is happening with the 4 wives. However, if you are now a Muslim in the Netherlands or in Norway or Denmark, you are well off. Why? Because what you do is this, and this is something that has shocked the poor people in the Netherlands and Denmark and so forth. They have figured out that because of the social systems there, a Muslim will marry officially, you know, civil law marriage, right, first wife, who wants to then marry a second wife, will divorce the first wife, but stay married according to the Islamic law. Because you have a double, you have civil and Islamic marriage. Stay married according to the Islamic law, so they're still married, and the state will pay for a house, childcare, everything. And then he goes and lives with the second one, and then following his duties goes up and down, because you have to, one night here, one night there, you know that, right? I always say it must be so tiring, but anyway, that's not my business. I've met several men who have more than one wife. But I never dared to ask them, how tiring is it? So, are there any other questions? Yeah?
In your very first story, you were telling about this man who said all these nasty things.
and why didn't the Christians speak up and counter him? It's not that easy. They might be under death penalty if they did.
Right, right. It is, first of all, they're scared. They're scared not to stand up to talk to him, against him. Secondly, nobody would listen to them. They would just talk to themselves. You know, because he says it on TV, and, you know, you're still in countries where lots of people are illiterate. Not everybody is well educated. And so the people just believe this man on TV because he's on TV. So it is a, yeah, absolutely, you're absolutely right. It is a huge issue. Yeah. Other questions? Yeah.
In the West, over the past five centuries or so, we've developed a critical intellectual culture. And I'm wondering, why didn't it happen with that blossoming of Islamic mm-hmm. culture in the Middle Ages? Why didn't it become intellectually critical?
Oh, that's such a good question. And we have, I can say it in a few minutes. This is what happened. What blossomed was astrology. Astronomy, not astrology. Astrology too, but astronomy mostly. Math, sciences, history. They even studied other religions, of course, to see how to cope with them, because, you know, Islam also went into India, and there were lots of Hindus, and they were not in the Quran. What to do with those, right? So, but in the 12th century, that was exactly the 12th century, so that was in 11 something, the madrasa was set up. And we all heard about the madrasa, haven't we?
Yeah.
Have we heard about, who has not heard about the madrasa? The madrasa is a Quran school. First thing you learn is the Quran by heart. Then you learn what I told you, the guys who interpreted the Quran in the dusty villages in Medina in the 7th, 8th century. Then you learn everybody else who then interpreted the Quran. If you were in the 13th century in a madrasa, you learned it up to the 13th century, 14th and so forth, till the 21st century. You learn everything that was said about the Quran. You learn how to recite the Quran. You learn how to read the Arabic, because, you know, not everybody. Arabic is a very difficult language. You learn the Arabic syntax, the Arabic grammar, and so forth, and so forth. There really is not time for philosophy or for other things that can disturb your mind. Because what you basically learn is orthodoxy. This is what Islam is and should be. And that system has lasted for almost 1,000 years. It has lasted till the C word of colonialism came in, and in the early 20th century, Muslims started to realize that because all they had done in their academic endeavors was focus on the Quran and all the related scriptures, they had not developed other sciences. You see, because if you look until 1250 and what happened in Spain and so forth, there was medicine, there was philosophy, there were all kinds of sciences that people were practicing together, and also Muslims, Christians, Jews were studying things together, right? But then that stopped, and the whole focus was the Quran. And when that system stopped in the 20th century, it was partly replaced by professions. Like, they had to train doctors, they had to train engineers, people who could make the railroads and things like that and keep them going. So what you have then is a split. You have, on the one hand, people learning vocational professions. Can I say that? Is that a word? On the other hand, people continuing in the madrasa. And so you get a huge vacuum. You get a gap. Because what's in the middle? Nothing. And that's the problem. What's in the middle comes from the West. You know, which books of philosophy, if they are read at all, are read? Western philosophers, Kant, Hegel, and so forth, hardly translated into Arabic, but mostly read in places like India, Indonesia, Malaysia, which are outside the Middle East. So you see, you get a huge issue, because why? These philosophers and other,
you know, scholars of whatever they develop are all Western. So what are they if they're Western?
Infidels.
They're Christian, or even worse,
Jews.
Lots of them are Jews, right? And so you see there comes this very ambivalent attitude. So what do we do with this? We need this, we should use this, but can we apply it to the Quran? And that's why I suggested that book by Farid Eshaq, because he talks about the different ways or to interpret the Quran. And then there are people who are trying to lift up, let's say, the Western philosophical methods and ideas and apply them to the Quran, and then the whole Muslim world falls over them. They're being killed, or they're being exiled, they have to run for their lives, because the people guiding them are mostly from the madrasa. And that's what Farid writes about too. And so they have these very fixed ideas about what a Muslim believes and what a Muslim does not believe. And again, do you understand why there is little space for other ways of thinking about Christians and Jews? Now, we have to stop, right? Do we have to stop? Is it time? Huh?
Yeah.
Well, you can have about 5 minutes.
5 more minutes, okay. Because now...
I'm feeling hopeless now.
But no, I'm not done yet. Because we're going on and on. If you come back tomorrow, we keep going. No, the thing is that Israel comes on top of all that. Israel, that's not the C word, right? But Israel comes on top of that. So that is what you have, this kind of this attitude of, oh my gosh, we're recolonized again. The Jews have taken over. Everybody supports Israel. Nobody supports us. Now, we have to end with hope. So thanks for saying that, Dorothy, because it is not hopeless. Why not? Because as I say, there is this phase in the middle. And now we are in the 21st century, and we are in the era of globalization. And Muslims in the United States of America, and Muslims in places like Canada, are no longer of the mindset that I'm describing. And they have families at home, right? They go home to Egypt and to wherever they are from. And they import new ideas, and they invite the nephew to come here, and the nephew studies here. So what we are at is at a time of a great change, and that time is coming as we speak. There's going to be an enormous change. Unfortunately, Iraq came in between there, but the change is going on because this vacuum that is there of where do we get our philosophers? How do we get our science models, and so forth, is slowly being refilled by Muslims who have been born and raised and trained in places like the States. And there, they are slowly changing the face of Islam. For example, we have in America, African-American Muslims. Who of you knows any? Right? They have no business with the Middle East. Right? Have you noticed that? They don't even want it. There is a big conference every year of Muslims from all over the world. The African American Muslims have their own conference because they say we are Americans, and they have very many of them have mixed families. Often, their father. I know some of the Muslim women whose father was a Methodist preacher. And did you know why a lot of African-American Muslims became Muslim? Because of the, what do you call that now? Civil rights movement. That is what attracted them to Islam. It wasn't Islam. It was the civil rights movement. That they felt we can through Islam, change the racial map of the United States of America. And a lot of them told me that only later they became Muslims. So that is the hope where I want to stop with today, that we see this massive bulwark, and as we are in the 21st century, it is crumbling. It is crumbling. But we have to understand that it will take a while. But now we are getting more and more spaces when we can move in, and yesterday people said we have to witness, we have to study together, these spaces we have to use as much as we can, because that will bring the real change. Yeah?
Could that be why some Muslims feel so threatened by the West? Because they feel it's starting to crumble, and so there's a reaction?
Absolutely. And it, the whole, if you look at sociological analysis of, for example, suicide bombers in London and so forth, it is mostly seen as a reaction against globalization and development in the West. Absolutely, yeah. And also, what we also have to keep in mind is that Muslims themselves, as I said, they themselves never had to really deal with Christians and Jews. Did that come across? In how I described that? So but the good thing is, as I say, they don't really know what's in the Quran about Christians and about Jews. They don't really know about, because they are taught just screen it off. Don't mix with it. So that means there is a space too. There is a new space for Muslims to restudy the Quran. There's a new space for new interpretations and to replace the interpretations of the Middle Ages. And that is being done by Muslims here. That is starting by Muslims here. And one of the Muslims doing that is this Farid Esad. Why? Because he's from South Africa. So his concern was not the Middle East. B, he is very much active in the anti-AIDS movement. C, he was trained by Jesuits in Germany. D, he was trained at the University in Amsterdam in the Netherlands. And then E, he's a very, very gifted and very inquisitive and open-minded person. And this kind of people are changing the map of what we are looking at. He is the idol of young, let's say, progressive Muslims in America. He's their idol. They love to read him, they read everything that he writes, and they follow him. So things are changing. Yes.
Who is this person?
This one, the one from the book, Farid Esad.
Oh,
Farid.
Oh,
and he was trained by all things in the madrasa where the leader of the Taliban was trained. He's very smart. He's an African American from South Africa. He's very, very smart, and he told me how bored he was in the madrasa, and that he then would go to a church and read philosophy books in their library, and so that is how he started to have new and different thoughts. So Dorothy, does that help you a bit with the hope? Yeah? But you have to understand the bulwark. How it came about, that it is there, and then from there we go on and look at other options and new openings. Other questions, or do you? You said it's time for dinner. I had it. Okay. Well, thank you so much for coming then, and see you.